MacCast, Friday, June 3rd, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. If you are confused right now, thinking that I was not going to be delivering you a MacCast this week, I can completely understand, because I realized when I put out the last show, which was on Sunday, I had said I was going to be gone next week. Well, dependent upon when you were hearing the show and what might be happening, that could be a bit confusing. I am leaving this Sunday to go on vacation for a week. So WWDC is happening next week. I don't know if I'll be able to put out a show right away. Probably will be doing a show not long after the following week, probably early the next week. You'll get my thoughts and opinions on all the things that are announced at WWDC. But in this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about what's going to happen or maybe happen at WWDC, some of the latest rumors. But more importantly, I want to get to an interview that I did. If you've ever thought about making a Mac app or an iOS app and had this great idea and wondered how to get started and how do I put together maybe a company to start building Mac applications, or if you're just curious about the whole process that other developers of your favorite applications, what they go through or went through in getting their companies up and running, I'm going to have a chat with Michael Simmons. He's been around in the industry for a while, about his new project, new company, and I think you'll find it very interesting. We get into some of the technical details, some of just the ins and outs of building a business and that sort of stuff. So it was a lot of fun. It's always great to have him on the show. We've had him on the show in the past, and I hope you enjoy that. But before we dive into everything, I want to take a quick moment, thank a couple of our show sponsors. Gazelle, you know, we live in this age where technology kind of has this, they call it planned obsolescence, meaning that, you know, so often we will research, we'll try and find that perfect new digital camera, the new latest iPod that we want to get, whatever. But that only has a certain lifespan, and then the new version comes out, right? And it seems to happen quicker and quicker. And so there's this dilemma of, well, I want to get the latest and greatest thing, but I just spent this money. And then the other dilemma is that a lot of times the product you have is still a good usable product. Maybe you want the latest and greatest, but somebody else will be perfectly happy with your old gear. So we want to get rid of that stuff. We want to sell it. And Gazelle offers a great way to do that, where you don't have to deal with the hassles of doing classified listings or throwing it on auction sites. You just go to their website, gazelle.com. You type in the gadget that you have, search their ever-growing database of electronics, and then they make you an offer. You answer some simple questions about the condition, the types of accessories you have, and they will tell you up front, hey, we'll give you this much for that. And if you want to take advantage of that offer, you say yes, and then they will handle all the shipping. In some cases, they'll even send you a box. You send it in. Once it's received, they will verify that everything that you said about the product was accurate, and then they will pay you. They will pay you for that gadget, and you can get paid via PayPal, via electronic check to your banking account. You can even have the money donated to a number of charities if you just like to give back. And then your product stays out of the landfill. It's good for the environment, and another person who can use it gets it, and then you have the cash to buy the new thing that you want to buy. So nothing could be easier. Also, if for any items that are not of value, they'll handle the recycling for you. So if you just like to recycle it responsibly, they partner with BAN certified, CloudBlue, one of the most respected names in domestic recycling. So you know it's not going to end up over in China or something like that. And lots of different options. So you can check out all of their information and details over at gazelle.com, as well as get offers on your used gadgets. Check them out today and see what your gadgets are worth. And I'd also like to thank Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You know, Deep Freeze, if you haven't checked it out, go over to Furonix.com, read up on it. But basically what Deep Freeze does is it allows you to set up your Mac or PC and then freeze that setup and configuration in place. So you load on the operating system, you load on all the applications and things like that. This is perfect if you're in a government organization, you work in the hospitality industry, you're in education, for your business, especially if you're running a small to medium-sized business and you have employees who are using systems, you can set those up, get them all prepared, get all the software that you have licensing for, and then you can lock that configuration in place. You can freeze it in place. You run deep freeze, basically creates an image of that, and then you deploy it in your environment. Users can use it. They're not restricted. They're not getting pop-ups that are saying, you can't go here, you can't go there. You can define areas of the system that they have access to. You can even set up what's called thaw spaces, so places where they can store persistent data like documents. You can even thaw a whole home directory, so that's great in OS X. You can just say, user directories are fine. People can store files and stuff there, but I want my operating system protected. I want my applications folder protected. And then they go ahead and use the system. If they've installed something someplace they're not supposed to, simply reboot the system. Deep freeze will kick in and restore that system back to its original state. So Mac defenders out there now, this is great if you were in an education environment. If you had deep freeze on your system, Mac Defender might pop up. Say a student installs it. They run it. They go through the process. It gets on there. It's annoying. They call up the IT department. You're the IT manager. They say, we've got this on our system. What do we do? You say, you know what? Simply reboot it, or you could even log in remotely and reboot it. It has full support and integration with Apple's remote desktop. Reboot that system. Boom. It is gone. You don't have to worry about it. You've reduced your IT costs. You've saved time on maintenance. It is a really great product, and you can get more information and details. You can even get a free trial to try it before you buy over at Pharonix.com. And a big thank you to both Gazelle and Pharonix for their support of the MacCast. So before we get into the interview with Michael, a couple things happening. WWDC is almost here, right around the corner. Steve Jobs is doing the keynote along with some of the other Apple executives on Monday the 6th. I think it starts at 10 a.m. Pacific time. And we've had a couple rumors, a couple things landed this week that are giving us some details about what we might see. It had already been revealed through Apple's own press release that they're going to be talking about iOS 5, Mac OS X Lion, and something new called iCloud. Now, we've had inklings and rumors about what iCloud might be. It's probably going to be a merging of MobileMe in its current form, along with a couple of new services, most significantly likely something with iTunes. I'm guessing it's going to be a lot more than that. I think there's going to be really tight integration, both with iOS, Mac OS X, and iCloud. I think we're going to see Apple reveal some details about the future of how they're going to merge and bring all of these systems together and tie everything into kind of a nice, neat package. So I'm really excited to hear what's announced on Monday. Banners started going up at Moscone Center, and an observant passerby, I don't know if it's just passerby, probably somebody actually sort of stalking the Moscone Center to see if they could get any information. Anyway, snapped a picture of a banner going up, and we now know what the iCloud icon looks like, or at least there was an image of what we believe to be the iCloud icon, and it looks kind of like the merging of the little cloud icon that you see on your iDesk right now and the iSync logo. I think I had mentioned last episode that Apple is discontinuing iSync in Mac OS X Lion. So sounds like some of those technologies are being brought together under the iCloud banner, at least if this logo is any indication. We're also getting a lot more details about the music portion of it, the iTunes iCloud Music Locker service. Don't know specifically what to call it yet, if it's going to be branded as something separate. I do think what's going to happen as far as the branding goes is that Apple is going to have iCloud as a platform, and then we're going to have different applications and services running on top of that. So I don't think they're going to update MobileMe Mail. I think that's MobileMe Email is going to be on top of iCloud. I think we're also going to have iTunes services on top of iCloud. Apple reportedly finally signed the fourth major record label, Universal. They had been the one holdout. They had reportedly already signed Sony, EMI, and Warner Music. So the deals have been done. The rumor is that Apple is paying up to $150 million in advances to the labels to get access to streaming rights for music. This is something that Google actually wasn't able to do with their new music service. And so the record labels have kind of alluded to the fact that Apple's going to be able to offer more and better services because they're doing the licensing deal. That remains to be seen, but we'll get details on that on Monday. Rumors as far as pricing goes, nobody really knows. I thought it would be integrated as part of just the yearly MobileMe service or now iCloud service, something about like $99 a year, and it would just be part of that. I also thought maybe Apple might do a little add-on piece. LA Times reported this week that they will launch with a free trial of the service, and then it will be an add-on at $25 a year, not a month, at $25 a year, which I think is really pretty good pricing. I think a lot of people would take advantage of that. As far as what you're going to get, we don't really know, but most people believe it's going to be the ability to stream all of your iTunes music from the cloud to your Macs, PCs, and iOS devices. It would supposedly scan your entire iTunes music library and allow access to anything that was in your library, regardless of whether you purchased it through Apple or ripped it yourself or got it through some other mechanism. If you have a lower quality version, they're saying you would get access to a higher quality bitrate version, the one that is on Apple's servers. So I would guess that would be the 256 kilobit AAC format that you actually download. Now, you'd be able to stream that. I don't know what's going to happen on the downloading side. My gut reaction is that you would be able to re-download. I'm really hoping that we're going to be able to re-download our iTunes purchased music. I think that will be allowed. I find it hard to believe that they would allow us to re-download higher quality versions of the stuff we ripped ourselves or got through some other mechanism. I think that's going to be locked to being streaming only. As far as if they do allow the higher bitrate audio to be streamed, Cult of Mac did an interesting thing. Something that I wondered about was looking at, with the 2 gigabyte data cap, say on your AT&T or Verizon plan, at least here in the States, and I think actually internationally, a lot of the plans are capped even tighter than that bandwidth cap limit on 3G connections. How much music could you actually stream at various qualities? And what they determined was at 96 kilobits, which is radio quality, you're looking at about 45, 46 hours of streaming per month. At 160 kilobits, which is 3G quality, 28 hours. And at 320 kilobits per second, CD quality, you're looking at only 14 hours of streaming music a month. So I don't know how Apple's going to get around that. I guess Spotify, which is a very popular streaming service in the UK, I'm not sure all of the countries that they're in quite yet, they've been trying to get into the States. They supposedly stream at 320 kilobits per second, but only over Wi-Fi. And you can see why. It does eat up or chew through quite a bit of bandwidth. So those of us who have been able to hang on to our unlimited data plans, I think, are going to be happy that we have them if this turns out to be the reality, if we are able to stream this music. And hopefully Apple will be able to work out something maybe with AT&T and Verizon later to allow this content, more streaming of this content. Because we've also had rumors this week that Apple's trying to do deals with the TV studios and the movie studios to bring video content to some sort of streaming service through iTunes and iCloud. And were that to happen, the bandwidth just goes out the window. So I don't know what's going to go on there. It might end up being Wi-Fi only, at least at first, until maybe 4G gets more widely deployed. We're also hearing that Twitter integration is going to be a big part of iOS, macOS 10 Lion. I think a tweet went out from Robert Scoble that said it's going to be much deeper than a lot of people are thinking at this point. Twitter just launched a new photo and video sharing service. So there were a number of sites that were saying that was what Apple was working on, but sounds like it's going to be even more. And it's going to be throughout both the desktop and the mobile operating system. So imagine a lot of your applications being able to tie into Twitter and do different things. So if you're a Twitter user, that's probably a big deal. If you're not on the Twitter bandwagon, well, then I guess you probably really won't care, but I'm sure it's going to be an opt-in, so you can choose to use it or not. But that is another rumor that we heard about this week. And then something that I'm a little bit disappointed about, should this become reality, we had been hearing rumors that Lion Server was going to be integrated in along with the desktop operating system. And the thought process was that when you went to install macOS 10 Lion, it would ask you, do you want to install the desktop version, or do you want to install the server edition? And you just get to choose, and you could have one or the other for the same price. The French site HardMac claims that they've found a reference in the OS 10.7 help files that seem to indicate that Lion server is actually going to be a paid upgrade that's integrated into the distribution of Lion. So you would reportedly have the option to install server, but then it would prompt you and then send you to the Mac App Store and you'd pay. No one knows what the pricing is going to be. Currently, pricing for Snow Leopard server is $499, but you'd pay an additional price and then it would download and install and unlock the different components to make your version of Lion into the server version. So I was hoping that we'd have the option to just install server out of the box. I think more and more these days, there's becoming a good reason for people to want to run home servers, home server versions of Mac OS X, and it would be nice if that was easier to do, but I certainly understand Apple wanting to get some extra licensing. And as far as price, as far as how pricing is going to end up on Lion, I've heard rumors to both sides that it's not going to be as cheap as Snow Leopard was, so that $30 price point, but more affordable than the $129 that Apple used to charge for the operating system. So maybe falling somewhere between the $30 and the $129. But for sure, we're going to know a lot more come next week because the keynote's on Monday and I am getting jazzed and very excited about it. So I'm going to be following along remotely and we'll certainly be talking about all this stuff and a lot more on episodes of the MacCast coming up in just about a couple weeks. So stay tuned for that. And that's the update on what's happening in the lead up to WWDC. Now I want to jump into my interview with Michael Simmons from FlexiBits. I had an opportunity to sit down with him. He just started up a new company. They're making a great piece of Mac software that I wanted to let you know about. But more importantly, I wanted to maybe go behind the scenes, dive in and find out from Michael what it takes to get an idea and then realize that idea for a new Mac application. And we often don't get to see that side of the business. We talk about, you know, the apps we use and what we like about them and things like that. But what about the process of actually building an application? How do you get started with that? What do you do? What are some of the challenges? What are some of the rewards that come out of it? And if you have a great idea, how can you just get started? I know a number of you have asked me about that. And so it was just fascinating and a lot of fun to go behind the scenes and sit down and talk with Michael. So take a listen. So I want to welcome to the MacCast someone we heard before, Michael Simmons. He's been on the show, but he's been in the industry working with Macs and Apple products, been with Apple, Ambrosia, Cultured Code. But for the past year, Michael, you have been launching your own thing. FlexiBits is the new company, right?
That's right.
And so you've been doing that now for about a year. You have a new product that we want to get to. It's really, really exciting. I've been using it for a while now, and I think people are going to be very impressed. But before we get to Fantastical, that's the name of the product, I want to talk a little bit about the whole process of sort of launching off, spinning off, and starting up your own thing. Because I think there's a lot of people in my audience, I get the question a lot, hey, I have this idea, and this comes from all different sides. You're on the marketing and business development side and user interface side. Can you talk about how you found a partner, you started up this company? Can you talk about that process of sort of getting started when you decide, okay, I have an app, I have an idea, I want to start doing my own thing?
Yeah, sure. So the first thing, of course, you need for an app or a company is an idea. And correct. You have to figure out if it's a good idea, of course. And, you know, that's where you usually start. Mm-hmm. So as mentioned, we started FlexiBits a year ago, actually, May 2010. And it's my business partner, Kent Sutherland, and myself. And he had come to me with an engine for a project that he was working on for university. And it was a natural language engine. It basically parsed text and then made that text into doing something. You could make commands out of the text. So then, well, what do those commands do?
Right.
The key. What is it going to do? And immediately I knew we needed to do a calendar application. So he had the idea for this engine, which was basically a project, and I came up with the idea to do calendaring, having the engine be that you could type in a sentence and then it would create calendar events. So there you go. So we started with an idea.
Okay. So here's you mentioned the idea. I mean, idea, obviously very important, probably the most important thing. Two things that you mentioned in there that are one thing that you mentioned and one thing that I want to ask you about. So the one thing that you mentioned is just, you know, the idea itself and knowing how do you have a good idea? So what's the process? What's the filter? I mean, you just decide internally? Do you throw it out to people? Because a lot of people are concerned, I don't want to give away my idea because someone might steal it, right? So how do you go about validating that it's even a valid concept?
Yeah, that's a good point. So for me, what I usually try to use as the bar of something being a good idea is if it's something I would use. I'm a picky user. I've been in the industry a long time. I know what I'm doing. I assume most Mac users, and this is a pretty fair assumption, are picky users. That's why they use a Mac.
Right.
And if they love apps and they're kind of wanting to do an app, they probably have a hungering for something better. That's the whole reason probably of wanting to do this app. So if it's something that you want and you're going to develop it for yourself and you're also going to develop it to be something you would use that stands out above the rest, it's probably a good idea. Now, sure, you can share this idea with people. In our case, we didn't, because once the idea of this natural language engine existed and I knew about it and I talked about doing a calendar app, I knew I had to have it.
Right.
The state of calendaring on the Mac isn't really helpful. There were no apps like this that existed at the time that we knew of anyway.
Mm-hmm.
During the process, we ended up discovering a couple of them existed, but we were already in development. It wasn't like we copied them. And in fact, it was interesting to see it because then we could kind of see what other people were doing. But at the time that we came up with it, no, I mean, that's one other thing I'd also advise is that you come up with an idea, look around, see what's out on the market, see if this app already exists. Maybe it doesn't, maybe it does, and maybe it does in a bad way so you can then improve on it.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly shouldn't not go forward with your idea if something exists, if you think you can improve it.
Well, so let me ask you about that dichotomy, because you mentioned something that I think is significant in that sometimes going out and looking at what other people are doing can kind of taint your idea, or there's concerns that it might influence you in a negative way. It sounds like you came up with the idea, had it kind of at least somewhat planned out or had the concept in place, and then kind of did your research. I mean, do you advise more that approach? Does it really not matter?
I think it's really depending. You know, there's not a one size fits all to this.
Right.
I think you basically have to figure out, again, looking at competition, looking at the market, every idea holds its own merit. And every idea is to, you know, it's almost like beauty's in the eye of the beholder, right? Someone may come up with a great idea for a game or a great idea for a productivity app that might only be appropriate for a segment of the market. So it really boils down to the actual idea. I mean, if you have, I don't know if you have a more specific answer that you want me to give, but I think
right.
It really depends per idea.
Well, I think that leads into the other thing that you mentioned a little bit, which is develop for yourself. You know, how do you decide that idea is good? And I've heard this over and over in a bunch of scenarios. Actually, as a matter of fact, my podcast is an example of that. When I started the MacCast, I started it because I couldn't find the podcast that I wanted to listen to. And I thought, well, you know, maybe if I want to listen to this type of format or this type of show, there's going to be other people out there that want to. So I really kind of did the podcast as a show for myself. And then other people wanted it. And I've heard that same kind of story over and over again. And that sounds like what you're saying with this idea is like, you know, this was just something that I saw that I could use. I think the flip side of that you mentioned there is that you also then have to kind of determine, is there maybe a market that's large enough where this makes sense? It could still be a highly specialized market, but do you have enough people that you can sell to? And then I think that leads into some other questions that I think get answered later, which is how much do I sell this for? You know, where am I going to market it? How can I maybe expand my market? If you look at it and you go, well, my market is really highly specialized, but if I tweak this idea in a couple different ways, I can kind of open up that market, right?
Exactly. And your example with the podcast, you did what you wanted because it didn't exist. That's really what it's all about. If there are other apps already on the market that exist and you're going to just reinvent the wheel, and by that I mean literally reinvent the wheel, you're not doing anything to change it or make something different, then you're probably not going to succeed.
Right.
You specifically wanted a specific type of podcast that didn't exist, you made it, and they came.
Right. Right.
So what it boils down to is you come up with an idea, you look around and see if it exists. You know, maybe an idea even comes up because it doesn't exist. I have many friends who have developed apps that, in our sense, okay, we decided we were doing our own company. Kent had this idea of the engine, or already not even the idea. He had the engine. I had the idea of the calendar. We came together, sort of like peanut butter and chocolate. But then there's people who they're just sitting around and boom, they realize an app doesn't exist and then they want to make it.
Right.
I realize, of course, now making it, we're probably going to move on to the next topic, I'm guessing, of, well, what does it take to make an app, right?
Right. Right. Well, right before we do that, the other thing that you mentioned was the peanut butter and chocolate thing, you found Ken. And the other question that I get a lot is I'll have somebody who has an idea and they go, well, you know, I'm just a marketing person, or I'm just a programmer. It could be any side of this equation. I mean, there's lots of elements that need to go into making a successful application, whether it be for Mac or iOS or what have you. So, how do you go about finding people? And I think another part of this is how do you go about trusting your idea, you know, realizing you can trust your idea to someone. The example I have a lot in my mind is the app Yowza, because I know that those guys got together through Twitter. You know, it was like Rick Yeager and Greg Grunberg and all these guys.
Yeah, that's
kinda,
right. That's right.
You know, but that seems a little scary to me, you know, it's like going through the internet. But more and more, we're hearing about people connecting through social networking, through networking. I'm always of the mind, I tell a lot of my audience, well, why don't you do some traditional face-to-face networking? You know, go on meetup.com, and there's probably an iOS or a Mac developer group or some developer group in your area. And, you know, just go to a meeting, you know,
absolutely,
sit down and meet people.
Absolutely. There's a ton of gatherings. You know, there are these groups called Cocoa Heads, and that's gathering of developers that do Cocoa Heads. There are gatherings called NS Coder Night. In fact, the website, I'll just give it out now, it's nscodernight.com. That's nscodernight.com. That's another night where you can, you know, hang out with fellow developers and talk about code and stuff like that. And they have them in all different areas. I mean, I'm at their website now and just doing random, just to show you how broad it is. Santa Monica, California, Lexington, Kentucky, Costa Mesa, California, San Francisco, California, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
There's a ton of things. So there's all of these opportunities. And the thing I love best about the Mac community, and so many other developers talk about this all the time, is we are a community. We love to help each other. We don't like to steal each other's ideas. It just doesn't happen. We want to help each other. We want the platform to be better. We want to give our ideas out. We want to get better at what we do so then we can help other people get better at what they do. It's a very mentoring, entrepreneurial spirit of helping each other.
Yeah. So how did you find Kent?
So I found Kent many years ago. He was lost in a... Kent actually wrote an application that most people know about called Shacks.
Yeah, I love that.
I figured you knew about it. I mean, it's really incredible. I think I want to say it was back in 2005, if my memory serves me right. So it was about, you know, 7 years ago, 6 years ago. And I found bugs, or I thought I could improve it, or I wanted a feature request, probably all of the above.
You want to tell people what Shacks is for those who don't know?
Absolutely. Shacks is actually still available on Kent's private site, which is ksuther.com. That's ksuther.com. And Shacks is... I'll just read the description from his website because it's easier to do. It's a collection of modifications and enhancements or additions for iChat. So he uses minor modifications and additions. They're hacks. And what I mean by they're hacks is they allow you to do things with iChat that you couldn't have done normally. So for example, my favorite features that I use all the time are there's a log viewer. So if you log your chats, you can automatically search and find and organize all of your logs, including images, conversations, and
That's number one on my list, because you can do it in iChat rather than having to go out and use Spotlight or go through that folder that, you know, Apple creates.
And that was actually a more recent feature. And the cool part about this is, you know, I'd already known Kent for a while. Obviously, this feature only came into being, I think, about a year or so ago. I helped him with the UI and the UX on that, which is cool because we ended up becoming friends because of some of my feedback. But then Shacks ended up being something that I just helped him on. And then I just say, hey, here's a feature, or I'm testing, or this or that. We were friends, nothing more than that. But that's how I found him. And that's sort of how the community works. We became friends because I gave him feedback on his app. He admired and valued my feedback and asked me to help him more. And we became friends, and now we're really good friends and business partners.
Cool. So let's jump into that development part, like you're saying. I mean, the next step. So you've got the idea, you've got, you know, you and Kent. Kent's going to do the coding part, and you're going to be working on some of the design, UI, and stuff like that. Where does the whole process start? How do you get up and running? And I know there's lots of different approaches that people take. So I guess maybe just focus on the approach that you guys take. Did you start with the user interface and diagramming? Do you jump right into coding and just start throwing throwing bits at the wall and seeing what works and what doesn't work? What's the process like?
So for us, the process is this. First, we came up with the idea, okay, we need this app to be able to take his natural language engine and make calendar events with it. So we build a prototype. And what a prototype is, it's basically a simple, basic application that's going to work. It's going to do something. It's going to actually function, right?
So you start slinging code right away, it sounds like.
Yeah, right away in code. Well, his engine was done. So in our example, we of course have this luxury of the fact that this natural parsing engine, I mean, it wasn't done, don't get me wrong. It existed. Well, right. I should say done, right? It's never done, but you know what I mean.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So it was pretty straightforward in the sense that he needed to build this minor application, and Kent did this part, to make it, you type something in and boom, you'll get an event. Kind of like a proof of concept. Very basic, no user interface, a field, and maybe a submit button. You know, something very basic just to show that it'll work.
Mm-hmm.
Then from there, once you say, yeah, that works, you know, that is pretty cool. Then we start on the user experience and the user interface. And you've probably heard the terms UI, UX thrown around a lot, which is user interface, user experience. But to me, they are, and Kent as well, they are the paramount of our company. The application, how it's going to work, how it's going to feel, how, what it's going to convey, how you're going to interact with it. What are the expectations? What are the actual functions that end up happening and stuff like that? That's all part of the user interface and user experience design and development and implementation. And that's really important to us.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm now in this iOS group here in San Diego, iOS developers group. And, you know, I'm in it just to kind of maintain the networking. I haven't started an application yet. It's one of those things that I often think about, but just never seem to find the time for. And the guy who founded the group founded on this concept he calls ICAM. And ICAM, if I can remember it right, is interface coding, art and marketing. And he always says, he always puts art up as like the top thing in his mind, because he says, you know, it has to look good in order to be marketable. It has to function properly in terms of user interface. You know, the code can be great behind it, but if the user experience sucks, the app's going to be no good. Nobody's going to want to use it.
Absolutely.
So he puts a lot of emphasis on that. And because he's trying to open up the group, we want to make the group available to all aspects of this making an app. And I think a lot of people get bogged down. The technical is important. The code's important, obviously. But there's a lot of other things around that go into making a successful app. And I think a lot of app developers, when they have that idea and they're coming from a coding perspective, they think, well, I've got great code. That's all I need. I can make an app. And it really, you need help, right? You need these other pieces.
Exactly. And, you know, I'll start to get a little bit more deeper into our process and talk to you about how just important all of this was. I think it'll really drive home what we're getting at, because you clearly get it. And what you've heard from these meetings is also the same thing. The key elements of a great app are a great user experience, great user interface, but also an amazing icon. If you don't have an amazing icon, why bother? Because the icon is ultimately like the window to your store. When someone goes window shopping at a store, windows are always cool, right? There's always a nice window display.
Right. Or a book jacket on a book. I mean, talk to anybody who's been marketing books or selling books for a long time, and they'll say, you know, it's funny. Sometimes the content doesn't matter as much as the book jacket in terms of your sales.
I couldn't have said it better. But look at the cover on a book, right?
Right. It's at least going to get people to open up. I mean, you still have to have good stuff on the inside, but no one's going to want to take a look at it if it's not pretty, right?
And on the flip side, let's say you do have a great app with a great user experience, a great user interface, but the icon's bad, then someone's going to be like, oh, but the icon's bad. Like, it's still going to be a thorn. And why would you want a thorn? Why wouldn't you want the best experience possible?
Well, you know, and I think people listening are going to be nodding their heads when they hear this, but one of the first things I do when I hear about a new app, right, get a link, you see a Twitter feed, something like that, you click on it, you go to the App Store, you go to the Mac App Store, the iTunes App Store, and I start flipping through. I look at the icon, just like you're saying, go, okay. But then also you start looking through screenshots, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. your first impression is based upon how it looks.
Right. And especially if there's a price attached to it, if it's not free, you know, the screenshots are going to determine whether I click that buy button or not. a lot of times.
I'm nodding my head as well, and I'm even thinking, if the screenshots don't even look good, even if there's a free trial. Okay, so you see something that just has a piece of junk icon and a piece of junk user interface, boom, it's done. You're done, right?
Yeah, you're moving on to the next thing.
Done, exactly. And the end of the day, you need to have a great icon, a great user experience, and a great user interface, but those aren't even enough. But those are, I would even dare say, the baseline. Those are the minimums. If you don't at least have a great icon, a great user interface, you know, amazing icon, amazing, why bother? What are you doing that's going to make yourself stand out from the rest?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have to correct my iCam. I'm going to get in trouble when he hears this episode. It's the I is for ideas, obviously. We're going to start with an idea, right? Gotcha. Ideas, coding, art, and marketing. So those are kind of the four pillars that he talks about when developing any kind of application. So let's talk a little bit about that art process and stuff like that, because that sounds like where your passion lies in this is with the user interface UI design experience. So what process do you go through when you start building out that stuff? What are maybe some of the tools that you use? I'm assuming you do some diagramming. You start to play with layouts and button placements and stuff like that. What kinds of tools are you using when you're trying to come up with your user interface?
Well, the first tools actually are pretty crude. I use a pencil and a piece of paper. Paper prototyping is actually the best way to start figuring out how things are going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you just sketch it out, it's even good to cut stuff out, you know, like cut out cells or cut out, for especially on the iPhone, cut out little buttons, and then you can move them around and you can kind of tweak with them in reality. The reason why paper prototyping is helpful, even on a Mac, is if you sketch out what you're doing and you kind of have it movable around, you make it more tangible. Now, you can do all of this in Interface Builder. You can just drag stuff out and do an interface, but there tends to be a different, I don't know, there's just a different experience by doing it on paper.
Well, I would imagine as much as we like the technology and it's cool to see something that looks more like a finished thing, I think for me, if I was thinking about it, and I do the same thing because I do web development, right? And a lot of times my web designs and the UI for that will start out, you know, on a piece of paper or in the Moleskine, right? And it's an idea and you're just quickly sketching things out. One, I think it's faster. And two, I think that it's easy early on if things are kind of looking somewhat pretty and finished and stuff like that to get lost in that, to not see past that. If I'm making sense, yeah. It's kind of an esoteric thing to talk about on the radio, but to be able to just move things around and not have things look like they're actually going to look, because you're not at that stage yet, I think, where you've kind of set, you're looking at functionality. You're not trying to set the polish, the look of the thing. You're not trying to figure out what color it's going to be and what a specific button may or may not look like. It's more like you want to be still in that functionality mode.
Correct. This is totally, totally substance over style at this point. It's all about interaction, user experience. Back to the user experience. That's why they're separated. User experience is how it's going to work. User interface is how it's going to look and actually, you know, function.
Right.
So, yeah, so we did, you know, the paper stuff. We kind of sketch stuff out. We come up with some ideas. We kick it around. We had audio chats and phone calls and kicked around ideas and then back and forth.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So with paper prototyping, I'm assuming you and Kent are in different locations. How are you sharing these things back and forth? Are you, you know, pacing up and scanning them in? Are you taking iPhone pictures? Are you using some sort of screenshotting tool? Or what are you doing at that point?
So most of the stuff on paper was just done by me. I did share it with him, whether I held it up, you know, during a video chat or whatever, just to discuss it.
Uh-huh.
There's, it's not, paper prototyping isn't something where, you know, it's very formalized that you have to be like, well, here it is, you know, you must see it. You know,
right.
It's more working out the complex problems and then coming up with something that feels well, and then you kind of share it. So then at that point, then you can start to build something in Interface Builder that is functional, that at least is still, it's still a wireframe, right? It's still not polished. It doesn't have any sort of aesthetic, but now it's starting to become functional where you can start to interact with it and see how it's going to work.
Okay. So you move, your process to move straight from kind of the paper prototyping right into Interface Builder.
Yep. And the paper prototyping, just so you know, it's not something you take a long amount of time to do. It's more of a get it out of your head, sketch it out, see if it makes sense, play with it a little bit, start to tweak with it, and then get it into the computer so you can actually then really start to figure out how it's going to work.
Can you talk a little bit about, just for people who don't know Xcode and Apple's developer tools, the sort of relationship between Xcode and Interface Builder, the different tool sets?
Sure. So Xcode ultimately is a suite of tools. It's available free if you're part of the developer program. If you're not, you can buy it on the Mac App Store for, I think it's like $5. It's $4.99. And there's an app called Xcode, but it's kind of interesting. So Xcode is this whole suite of tools.
Right.
Which includes a lot of different things. I won't get into how many different things there are, but it's a whole bunch of different things, including Interface Builder. And then there's the application called Xcode itself. Now, that application, that Xcode application is where it's the actual integrated development environment or IDE that you do your coding in.
Right. That's where you're going to have all your library files and the code that you're going to be working with.
Exactly. But Interface Builder is what you actually use to create your graphic user interfaces.
Right. And it's a really visual tool if no one's ever seen it, and you have all the little widgets and objects, and you can sort of start building out different screens and different you know, interface elements and dragging them. Like you said, you literally can drag little objects out, you know, dials and sliders and all the things that we're used to seeing. But you still need to then link those up within Xcode, right? You sort of, there's this whole process of linking the code to the buttons and objects tables and data areas and stuff like that, right?
Well, yeah, sort of. So in Interface Builder itself, you create your interface with all of these objects, you know, text fields, windows, stuff like that. But in Interface Builder itself, you actually wire this stuff up. To build out your interface, you're actually going to take your objects, and then they have things called actions, which are messages.
Mm-hmm.
And then the objects send these messages, which get connected to targets, which are in the application's code. And there's also outlets, which are declared again in the application's code, get connected to specific objects. So you do a certain level of linking all of this stuff up in Interface Builder, but then in your actual Xcode project, all the initialization gets done before runtime. So it's really nice. You do everything. They're called nib files.
Right.
So you create nib files in Interface Builder. Those are your interface files, which include the elements of the user interface along with all of these outlets and pointers and messages to the objects. And then you link all of these nib files up with your project in Xcode.
Cool. Yeah. So the reason I wanted to kind of give people that from, you know, we got a little technical there, but hopefully not too deep for everybody. But what I wanted to point out is that within the tool set, these are kind of separate things, and it does allow you a certain amount, it sounds like during your development process, a certain ability to kind of divide up the work. Like you're on the user interface, user experience side, so you can play around with that stuff. You can have code going on, maybe stuff Kent's working on in the background, and then you can kind of start to bring these things together, right?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, the nice thing about the way we work is I have enough experience doing development that I understand what's going on. I know all the minutiae in terms of how everything integrates with each other, how a user interface works, stuff like that. But I'm not a programmer. I don't actually code. I know enough about it that it helps me in my design because I don't have to make assumptions that are incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
I then discuss it with Kent. We talk about the amount of time, the amount of effort, and so on and so forth. But I definitely recommend if someone wants to get into user interface or user experience or just doing product development from a creative point of view, you should definitely learn the code and definitely learn how this stuff works. You don't necessarily have to code, but you should definitely get a grasp of how this stuff works, because just being like, oh, that would be cool if we had an animation that flipped the screen around five times, and you know, that may be a year's worth of work.
Right.
You may say, well, sure, that seems easy, but until you really know what's involved and all the frameworks and core animation and all of the things that are involved, it really is so much more helpful if you understand what's going on.
Okay, so let me ask you this. How do you do that? I know how I've done it in the past, and I'm curious if your experience has been the same as mine. But hey, so how do you learn that stuff?
So you learn it through really playing with code. You work with code. You actually open up the sample projects. You open up a nib file. You open up an XIB file. You look in this stuff. You figure out what makes it tick. You play around. You know, you won't break. You just make a copy of it and then try again and try to just figure this stuff out. Go to meetings like NS Coder and Cocoa Heads. Talk to people. Just try to get as much experience and knowledge as possible. And there's a lot of outlets out there to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really, I think that's the way, you know, I've learned a lot of the stuff that I know is just through doing stuff, you know, through getting in and getting your hands dirty and working with the stuff and going through. I mean, there's tons of tutorials online. Apple has tons of sample projects that they include. I think they now have a whole series of, ebooks that you can get for free, right? Through the iBook store.
That's exactly right. There's some great developer books on it. And I will say that books are great for reference, but
right.
I don't personally recommend learning via books. So it's good to read these books, especially the free ones from the Developer Connection, to get some sort of basis. Okay, this is stuff and blah, blah. But until you really start to dig into the code, I can't say it enough, actually working with the code is going to be the best experience and the best education you get because you're doing it. You're actually just by trial and error or just by seeing examples, you're actually in the code.
Yeah, that's why I kind of like the, and I always did this with a traditional book, but it's kind of cool with my iPad now because I have a stand next to my computer with my iPad on it. I can bring up the iBook on that screen and then have Xcode, Interface Builder, all the tools up on my Mac, and I can be going back and forth. And when they talk about something, you can pull up, you know, when they're talking about a certain panel in Interface Builder, pull it up and like look at it and be like, oh, okay. And then they'll talk about here's how you add something to the interface. And then you can literally do it at the same time you're reading about it. And I find that a really useful way to kind of dig in and learn this stuff. And you can see what's happening on the screen. And then you can go look at the underlying code, which the book's often not going to show you, right? You can like dig under and go, okay, I see what that just did. I put this object on this panel, on this window, and underneath it wrote all this code. And you might not understand exactly what the code is doing, but you can at least kind of start to deduce and get how things are linked together and hooking up. I would agree that's very valuable.
Exactly. That's the key. You're actually working with it so it clicks in your head rather than, you know, these are going to be new concepts to a lot of people who haven't done development. So to read about it and actually experience it, you know, it's the same thing.
All right. So that's kind of the code and the UI stuff. One thing I want to touch on, and then I really do want to get to talking about the new application because I think it's really exciting. I'm really enjoying using it, and I think people when they see it after hearing this, they're going to understand why it's so good, right? And all this thought that went into it. But I want to talk about because you have some great graphics on here too. So you know the interface elements and interface builder and stuff like that are gonna be the buttons and things like that. But there's also, like we talked about, the icon. There's going to be background graphics and other images and things like that that go into building your app. How do you create those things? Are you working with outside designers? Are you doing that stuff in house? And then what are some of the tools that you use to kind of help create graphics? And then some of the challenges. I know that, you know, we talk a lot about screen resolutions and Apple's, you know, changes icon sizes, and we now have, you know, iPads and Retina displays and stuff like that. How do you deal with all that kind of stuff?
So to answer your question about the design, we did the majority of the user interface and user experience. We then can't paint pretty pictures. So
right.
You can do it in basic Aqua, right? Make it look just plain, which is fine. I mean, there's nothing actually wrong in doing an Aqua interface. Sometimes it's actually the best way to go. Sometimes making a custom interface is actually just gratuitous.
Right.
But we knew that we wanted to have a specific look for our app because we wanted it to be different and nice. So we worked with one designer. We found a designer that was going to help us with the user experience and user interface. It's good to find a designer that's not just a painter or a drawer or an artist, if you will. You want them also to have a knowledge of how this stuff works too, because then they can collaborate with you and even give you better ideas. And the designer we used originally, he was good, and we had some good stuff going on, and we got a final design, but it just didn't. I knew it wasn't right. I can't explain why. It's one of those taste things.
Sure.
But we felt like it could be better. And this was about probably, I want to say 3 months ago. So we're pretty close to shipping at this point. But, you know, we're thinking it's just not right. It's great. It's good even. It's good. It's great even. But it's just not right. So we decided to find another graphic designer who I knew was incredible. And his name is Raji King. And we started working with him and collaborating with him. And he actually helped us with some of the UI and UX elements. It wasn't just that he painted pretty pictures. And you have the interface that you see today.
Very cool. Do you happen to know what kind of tools and stuff that he works with or works in?
I know that he works with Photoshop. I believe he also works with Fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know his exact repertoire.
A lot of the traditional tools that designers are going to work with when creating actual pictures and stuff like that. I would assume Illustrator, all the standard stuff that we've used.
Yep, that's right. And just to give him a quick plug, his website is actually komodomedia.com, which is K-O-M-O-D-O media.com.
Mm-hmm.
His icon interface design art is just incredible. It really is true. He's an inspiring artist, and the work that he does is great.
Do you happen to know what some of that, anybody who's ever worked in this, I've done some icon design for people and worked in sort of the screen medium, and it really is a whole separate art. So I think your point of like trying to find the right person who understands the technical aspects, like you can't just go out and hire a traditional illustrator who maybe can do a lot of ink on paper stuff necessarily. They kind of have to have an affinity for doing on-screen stuff. There's a certain talent to manipulating pixels at a bit level. And you can tell the difference when, somebody has somebody who knows that stuff, the end result is better. Exactly. You can tell.
No, exactly. And, you've seen the apps that have kind of, there's an illustrator who did the artwork, and you'll notice that the artwork, it doesn't really look like computer artwork. It almost just looks like a painting or something. It's just kind of weird, right? It's awkward. That's probably a good way to say it. It's awkward. So
right.
You need someone who, again, like you said, it's a special talent. They need to be able to work with the medium.
And so was it the same kind of process that you went through in finding your designers? I mean, just networking, I would assume, right?
Yeah, and there's great websites like Dribbble. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's actually three Bs. It's DRIBBBLE.com. There's a bunch of great artists just sharing their work on there. And what they do is they actually collaborate. It's such a great website, Dribbble. The artists will help other artists. So, for example, let's say an artist is working on just some random project. Just, hey, I want to draw something.
Mm-hmm.
They can do what's called a rebound. Other artists will actually make a version of that thing with their own spin on it. And then you start to see collaboration. And people will then also post projects they've worked on. So they'll be like, Raji posted something on Fantastical. The designer of our icon, which I love our icon. I know I'm biased, but I love it. It was done by Icon Factory, but it was done by the artist David Lanham. David Lanham posted his icon on Dribbble, and the comments were great. And you get feedback from people about things. You get these other artists chiming in and designers chiming in about things that they missed. Oh, that pixel is off. No one's perfect. So it's really great to have this community of artists actually looking over the work and collaborating and providing input on the artwork.
Right, right. Okay, well, I want to get to the app, but I did, right before our interview, I tweeted out and asked some people if they had any questions for you. And we did get some development questions. So I got three here I want to go through real quick. The first one's from Frederick Pollock. And he says, what's the hardest part about development for you? I realize that's kind of an open question, but just pick one challenge you had during your project.
The first thing that came to mind is just shipping. Like the quintessential development problem is shipping. When do you ship? When is it done? I'll give you the answer. The answer is simple. It's never done. You just have to make a decision of when you think it's, the least worst.
Done enough.
And I say it that way because we know what the problems are. We know what we haven't implemented yet. We know what's left. And at some point, though, you have to ship it. There was a lot of really great comments that are said. But, one of the great comments I love to say is real artists ship. Because if you don't ship, then really, what does it matter?
Right. The famous Steve Jobs quote, right?
Exactly. And the other quote is, you should be embarrassed of your 1.0. You should ship your 1.0 and be embarrassed of it. And your 1.0 should not be perfect. It's a 1.0. You'll make it better. You'll get customer feedback. The product will be out there. I mean, sure, you don't want to ship something half-baked as 1.0.
Right.
But at some point, basically, if you're working on something over a year, it's time to ship.
You have to kind of let go and throw it out there.
As you see, we shipped in a year. I told you we started May 2010 and we shipped in May 2011. So we didn't sit down and say we'll ship in a year. We actually didn't.
Right.
We did say that if we don't ship by 18 months, which is a year and a half, we're doing something wrong. So we did kind of set up an alarm or an alert that's like, if we don't ship within this amount of time, you know, like do something. But we ended up shipping in a year. So the time of how long it takes to ship and stuff like that is never known. But I would definitely say, yeah, the biggest challenge is shipping and just getting it done.
Yeah. Garrett wanted to know, and I think we've kind of answered this a little bit, but maybe just a quick summary. What are some of the things that someone who's interested in starting to develop apps can do to learn the process of development?
Well, again, I definitely recommend getting into the groups like Cocoa Heads and NS Coder Night. Just so you know, I didn't give out the Cocoa Heads website earlier, which is just cocoaheads.org, and they are worldwide. So if anyone's listening in any other countries like Germany or Japan or the United Kingdom, they have them everywhere around the world, Cocoa Heads.
All right. And I'll make sure I have links to all of these sites and places that we mentioned in the show notes at mattcast.com. So,
okay, that's great. And yeah, I think really joining a group, collaborating with people, if there's a developer you like, let's say there's a software developer you admire, shoot him an email. Tell him you're getting into coding. Mac users really do love to help other people.
Yeah, use the power of the community. I think that's a really great point. Well, let's get into FlexiBits. I have one more question, but I think it's more relevant for after we talk about FlexiBits and Fantastical is what I meant to say. I said FlexiBits, but that's the company. The product is Fantastical. So you want to give everybody the quick elevator pitch as to what it is, and then we'll get into some of the details in the nitty gritty.
Okay, sure. And I don't mind talking about FlexiBits either. So obviously, I'll give you the quick elevator pitch on what FlexiBits is. We want to make software that's really different and cool. And we have a mission statement on our website, and we really mean it. We want to make applications that are fun, different, enjoyable, and flexible. Apps that'll really make your Mac better, that'll just remove frustration from your workflow and make things better. That's it. And because of us being users and being in the industry for a while and looking at other apps and having the opportunities to work on some great apps, we really know how important the experience is. And that's important to us. And Fantastical is actually a product of our thinking. Now, it's actually our second product, believe it or not. We had another product called Cameras, which was out for about a year. It's on a temporary hiatus. It's probably going to come back. I shouldn't even say probably. It will come back. I just can't say when. But Fantastical is now our product that we launched last week on May 17th. And it's a calendar application that lets you create events, look at your events, and manage your events in a really unique way.
You want to explain? I'm going to just let you roll right into the explaining right. That because you gave me the lead, and I want to hear from your perspective on, because I have my conceptions, but.
Sure. I didn't know how much more you want, but I'll get deep. So the crown jewel of our application is that engine that I talked about earlier, the natural language parsing engine. That allows you to create an event super easily. You open Fantastical and we have a menu bar icon, or you can use the keyboard shortcut. Type in an event like lunch with Adam on Wednesday at 3 p.m. or 2 p.m., whatever you want. It's up to you. In fact, if you don't type a time, lunch is generally at noon. So if you don't define a time, it picks out lunch at noon and it will give you noon. You hit return. It's in your calendar and you're back what you were doing.
Right. Yeah. I think that's the key. It's one of these applications that you have, and this is how I use it, you know, all the time. It's running there in the background. It's up in the menu bar if I want to take a look at it. But the typical workflow is you're on the phone, you're doing something else on your Mac, right? But it comes up, you need to set an appointment for something. So you hit a quick keyboard shortcut, up pops your window, and then you just type in exact natural, you know, sentence exactly what you wanted to do. And then magically you have this, we talked about the parsing engine that Kent came to you with that interprets that and is smart about it. Like you said, noon, if you say noon, well, that's, or lunch even, you don't even have to say noon, right? Lunch, it's going to assume that's around noontime. And of course you can come in later and tweak that, but you can do a quick entry, get back to work, right? But at least you don't forget to add that thing to your calendar.
Exactly.
Because that's my classic problem, right? It's like somebody be on the phone, you know, you're not thinking about that. I'm sitting in front of my Mac. There's no reason why I can't bring up iCal, but this is even much faster, right? Because I could just, as I'm talking to that person, type exactly what I'm thinking.
Exactly. And our engine, one of the key one of the key tenets, I guess, of our application was that if the engine wasn't really flexible or expressive, it really doesn't matter. Because if you have to teach someone in its syntax or have to learn a certain thing, it doesn't matter, right? Then what's the point? You're spending more time having to do something that you could have just done the other way. So our engine is very intelligent. It actually is a learning engine. Now, it doesn't learn on the fly. We teach it offline, if you will. During our alpha test and beta test, we collected thousands of, you know, samples from users that then the engine learned how to recognize things, sentences, phrases. And basically, this engine will get better over time. For 1.0, we wanted to put in the ability like we had during our alpha and beta test, where users can actually participate and submit incorrect sentences. Mm-hmm. It's not going to get right all the time. I mean, even if this is 5 years in the future, it'll never be 100%, right? You and I could have a conversation and you won't even get 100% of things that I communicate to you. It's just how it goes. So we want to make it clear. It's not ever going to be 100%, but we can always make the engine better and better and better by giving it more examples. So we intentionally held back for 1.0, because again, we want the user experience to be perfect, this customer participation of submitting or flagging incorrect parsings. The reason why we held it back was we care greatly about security and privacy. And when these sentences are going to get submitted, you'll have to opt in, of course. But when these sentences are submitted, where do they stay? How are they stored? Are they encrypted? Are they identifiable? Stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We really needed to ship. And obviously, we want to make the engine better, but having the product out and having the experience being better when the time is right, we will bring that reporting function back. So the point is yes, the engine will continue to get better in the future, and we definitely are going to add things to make that support better.
Right. So obviously, the big feature is this natural language parsing of events and things to get them into your calendar. But you also pointed out that this is a menu bar app, right? It's running in the background, so up there in your menu bar. It also adds some additional functionality, at least for me, to kind of be a quick day review sort of thing. Talk about some of the other features that people can use Fantastic Hal for.
Yeah, so as I said, we had this natural language engine, and we knew that we were going to do this. But part of the design that I wanted, because I'm really a big calendar person. Kent, believe it or not, didn't use calendars at all until our app. And it's kind of funny. This is how I knew I was onto something. When I was trying to sell him on the idea, because again, an idea, people who don't use calendars, he actually didn't think it was a good idea at first. So right. I sell him on the idea. But once I talked about the calendar, I said, well, it has to have more. I don't want to just create events. I also want to manage my events. I want to see my events. I want them in a quick way that I can quickly also review my events. And sure enough, that's how the user interface started to get developed. So yeah, to answer your question, we also have a nice event list and calendar that appear in the menu bar. And again, you can open it up by clicking the menu icon or using the keyboard shortcut, and that's user definable if you want to customize it. And we've done some really unique things with this interface in terms of color coding the events for your calendar, making them really easily findable. The list has some really cool custom stuff going on. So if you have a lot of events over one day, we have custom headers that are like the iPhone where they kind of slide up and then lock into the top. So then things scroll underneath it so you can still see what day you're on so it doesn't scroll out of the view. You can click your events to get information, like the details about that event. And then we even have a search interface, which lets you search for your events super quickly.
Yeah. Another one that I really like is the little, it's a little anchor toggle, right? Because sometimes I'll be, like I said, I'm using this a lot in the background and I'll want to jump back and forth between things. And normally with the menu bar, the calendar slides down and then it slides out of the way. But sometimes I want it sitting there right on top, right? So I can quickly click that anchor, bounce around, find that event or thing that I was looking to add and then jump back in.
Yep.
And then toggle that off. So it's not, you know, it's really quick and accessible. So there's little tiny things like that I think that, you know, set these kinds of applications apart. The other thing you sort of mentioned too is the color coding to quickly be able to run over something that's in my list, but then it highlights that up in the month view, calendar view. So I know exactly what day I'm sort of looking at for a specific event.
Yep, that's right. And these little tiny little touches, if you want to call them touches, they didn't just come out of, hey, we need to do that. We really discussed and debated what information is vital. What is the information that will help you plan your events? What's the information? There were a lot of things, obviously, we didn't put in, and you have to be restrictive. In fact, less is more. You want to try to only put in vital items because it's easy to just throw in a bunch of preferences and a bunch of functions, but then the application is going to be not as easy to use.
Yeah. Now, obviously, or maybe not obviously, but one thing I want to ask you about, something that happened probably during your development to a certain degree, was because this integrates, right? This integrates with iCal, it integrates with your syncing and stuff like that. But Apple kind of changed the syncing rules, at least with respect to mobile me calendars mid-game. Did that present some challenges for you guys?
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you brought this up. So to be honest with you, we were actually done basically with Fantastical 6 months in. So, you know, what is that, October?
Right.
Yeah. So we had a feedback from one of our testers saying, hey, iCal isn't running and my events aren't syncing. And what we realized was iCal, when quit, does not push or sync events. It requires iCal to be open if you have CalDAV calendars.
Right.
Now, on calendars that are on your system, those are okay because they communicate with something called calendar store, which is the local or older calendar method, storage method. But with CalDAV, which is what Google Calendar, Yahoo Calendar, MobileMe uses, you need iCal open. And we literally had to make the decision, do we launch iCal every time you add an event, or do we build our own implementation of CalDAV? And we chose the latter. And it was definitely not easy, and it definitely pushed the project out by, if you think about it, 6 months. No, it didn't take 6 months to write it. It actually, I would say, took about a month or two. But in terms of then tweaking stuff and the other implications that were introduced by having that, it had to be perfect. That's why we did it. So yeah, CalDAV implementation is something that we have, which really no other calendar app has. Their BusyCal has it. But I think in terms of the applications that are calendar helpers, if you will, I think we're pretty much the only one that have our own implementation of CalDAV. And it does change the user experience. And that's, again, what we're all about.
Right.
Your experience will now be good. You'll enter your and you've got your events in your calendars. You don't have to worry about it.
You'll get them updated. Yeah. So that is an interesting thing. And the decision to make your own engine, I think, goes to all those things that we were talking about earlier in terms of, you know, that's the kind of stuff that's going to set your app apart and really show that the time and effort was put into it. And that translates, right, to the user experience. And good user experience, I think, ultimately translates to more sales and more, you know, positive word of mouth and stuff like that, which is all these things are important to anybody who's starting this process of, I have an idea, right? Because I know there's tons of people out there right now going, I have this idea, and I had no idea there were all these nuances to realizing that idea.
Exactly. And the other thing I would say is, I get this question asked a lot. I've worked on a bunch of very successful apps in the past. And the question is, well, how do you make successful apps? What makes an app successful? It's really easy. Make the best app you can make. And I know that's so simple to say, but have a great icon, have great user interface, have a great idea. Everything needs to be the best it can be. And that's it. Once you follow that recipe of having everything the best it can be and you put all the care and the love in, you'll have a much better chance of success. And if you really are doing something different, you will be successful.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's a good point, too, is that, you know, it doesn't necessarily guarantee success, but you have much better chances, and you're going to have something that you're proud of at the end of the day, right?
And I think also you'll put your heart and soul into it, right? If you're going to do something that's the best and you truly are passionate and care about it, you will feel that much better about it because it will be a labor of love.
Right. Right. But you still need to have done that research. I think the last comment that you made, you know, is that it also does need to be something unique and different. You can't just copy something that's already meeting those goals that's already out there and just think that because your icon looks different or your user interface is slightly tweaked, that's necessarily going to translate to success.
Yeah, that's right. And really just believe in your product. I always talk about this, but Fantastical came about because it was something I wanted. Sure, Kent had an engine that did something, but he didn't know what to do with it. I wanted a calendar application because I knew that this would make my calendaring easier, and I knew that calendaring was a big problem. So this is something that I really wanted. So if it's something you believe in and have passion in and really want it, then make it the best it can be. And if you do that, it'll come through in your product. And sure, you need a good graphic designer. And sure, you need to hire companies like the Icon Factory to do your icon or someone like Raji King to do the artwork. And sure, you have to have a good programmer. And even if you can't program or don't even want to program, then you can find one. again, you can go to Cocoa Heads meetings, or you can go to NS Coder Night, and you can find programmers. There's a lot of programmers that maybe would help you with your project or even take it under contract work.
Well, let's talk about two last challenges I want to ask you about, and then we'll get to that last question, and then we'll probably get out of here. But
sure.
So how do you deal with the problem? Because I that's the other thing I get is like people go, okay, I get that I need to have a good icon, I need to have a good coder, but I have no budget.
Yeah.
You know, and then they feel frustrated, like they can't get started, like they have to have a ton of money to get up and running. And what would you say to someone like that?
I would say to find someone that also is interested in your project. So if you find a coder who, let's say you're come up with a great idea and he likes it, if he gets excited about it, he'll probably be willing to take a percentage of the sales.
Right.
He might work for free, right? So you really want to find someone that will be interested, because even if you have money, okay, so let's say you do have money and you have a project and the developer's not really interested in it, but then it becomes a means to an end. Well, I need a programmer, so I'll just pay this guy, but the guy's not into it. Well, you're probably not going to get great results. But if you get someone who's into it, he may even come up with ideas for the project that you didn't think of, and now you have a teammate all of a sudden.
Right. What do you think about things like Kickstarter and stuff like that? I know people are starting to turn to those resources now, too, as ways. I know that's more focused, it seems like, right now on hardware, but I think I've seen some software projects and art projects. I mean, it seems like they're expanding that concept, and I would imagine we're going to see some more of that sort of thing.
Perhaps. The only thing with Kickstarter is for software, and yeah, sure, it could work, is that it really would just let you raise money for an app. Unless they change the service and, you know, hire a developer, pair a developer up with
No, that's what I meant, just purely from a financial standpoint. So if you're going, sure, you know, I need $5,000. I have this great idea, but I need $5,000 to hire a coder and some artists or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah, sure, that could work. But again, even if you get $5,000 to hire a coder, I would still say be careful not just to get a developer that you're going to pay money to just kind of be a grunt and program.
Right.
You're really better off having a programmer who really sees the value in your product. And I would even say if you can get a programmer who sees the value in your product and actually is willing to do it by sharing some of the proceeds, I think that's even better. Because then again, the person has their heart and soul.
They're invested in it. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is classic startup stuff, though, right?
Absolutely.
You know, we could use Apple as our example, you know.
Yeah,
look,
exactly.
Steve are sitting in a garage, and they've got a great idea and no capital, but they just start building stuff, and they're passionate about it, and look where we are now, right?
Exactly. And keep in mind that Steve Jobs obviously saw something huge in the computer, and Steve Wozniak loved making computers because that's what he loved to do.
Right.
And out of love came Apple. So I always say this, but love what you do. And we say this too. We love our customers. We're really doing this. Everything we do, you can check our support and our Twitter account and everything. We are right on stuff because we're customers too, and we want to be treated and have the same experience that we would want. So just do everything the best way possible. Do everything the way you would want to be treated, and do everything the way you would want to use it and have an experience. And I really think success will be that much more likely.
Yeah. It seems like a simple thing, but it's often missed by a lot of people. And I often find myself shaking my head when I see those things. So the last little challenge I want to ask you about, because we've talked about you've poured your heart and soul into this thing, it's passionate, you throw it out there, you put 1.0 out there, and you know, maybe like you were mentioning, it's never done, so it's, you're always going to improve it. You get accolades, but very often times with those accolades come the criticisms, right? So how do you deal with those, and how do you not get disenfranchised or disheartened when you start hearing, you know, some of the negative comments that people are bound to make?
Yeah, I mean, it is hard because, again, if you love your product and you really have your heart and soul in it, you do take it personally. And right, you also take it personally because you want to make people happy. You want, if someone has a complaint, we don't usually assume someone's complaining to complain. We assume they're complaining for a legitimate reason.
Right.
So we really want to address that complaint. Now, unfortunately, there are a certain level of complaints that we get that are just, we'll just call them trolls.
Right.
They don't want to be helped. We'll get an example. We'll get a customer who says, oh, I bought your product, I don't like it, I want a refund. Now, we have a trial version, so why didn't you try it first? Okay, well, you know, whatever. But then we'll say, okay, well, what's wrong? How can we help? And they'll say, well, we don't want you to help, we just want a refund. Well, okay, so what can you do? Really nothing. They just want a refund. So you do that. But when you get some criticism about the app, like, for example, we'll get a lot of emails, not a lot, but we'll get emails, I don't like the way your application looks, I think the user interface is ugly. Okay, well, that's totally a personal choice.
Right.
I understand you find it ugly, so there's really nothing we can do. we could change our whole application for this user or two or three or four or whatever. But those are just things that you just kind of have to be like, wow, I guess they just don't like it. And that's just the way the world is, right? You're not going to please everyone, but you can do your best to try to please the majority. And you could try to do your best to do the best job possible. And then hopefully you can minimize some of the unfortunate disappointments.
Do you find sometimes that that feedback, though, too, is a becomes a marketing challenge where someone's not understanding a feature? Like there's a feature that you launch and you think, oh, this is really clear to us and was clear to our beta testers, but you start getting feedback and it maybe isn't. That sort of stuff happen?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, from our point of view, I actually look at feedback. Believe it or not, I like the negative feedback best because it really gives me more insight to what people are thinking differently, right? So I create these applications with Kent and we're looking at what we would do, what people would like, what would Apple do? We kind of have the bar, right?
Right.
But there are people, if they don't like our application, well, then it's out of our vision. It's out of what we think someone would want. So it's kind of good to hear this dissenting opinion to see, what are we missing? Now, sometimes it's just noise and sometimes it's unhelpful, but sometimes it's actually good. It's like, oh, wow, we didn't think about that.
Yeah. And so then I assume there's a process to roll that stuff back in, the stuff that is, you know, valid, and you go, okay, that makes sense.
Absolutely.
And then you rework that into your workflow and sort of continue this process like we're talking about of it never being done.
Yep. And we listen to all customer feedback. We've had feedback from customers already that we're already starting to implement in terms of, yeah, wow, why didn't we think about that? Or wow, that was confusing. Or, oh man, you know, there is an experience that we can improve, et cetera. So yeah, it's continuous improvement and you want to listen to your customers because after all, we're doing this for our customers.
All right. So the last question that I had is just a general FlexiBits question. And I think I might know the answer, but I could be surprised. Andrew wants to know, do you have any plans for any iOS apps in the future? Or are you guys going to be a purely Mac company?
We're getting a lot of requests for Fantastical on iPad or iPhone. And it's something we actually want to do. But right now, you know, we're focused on Fantastical for Mac. And we
just
wanna...
one thing at a time.
Exactly. And we really want to make Fantastical for Mac. We have a lot of plans already going on for Fantastical for Mac. We're going to have editing of events in app. We're going to have deleting of events in app. We're going to add proper BusyCal support. We do work with BusyCal now, but it's not proper support because there's some details we're waiting on BusyMac to implement before we can do it proper.
Mm-hmm.
By proper, it's like the experience we talked about earlier with the CalDAV sync. We want it to work. We don't want to have any kind of workarounds where we have to tell users, oh, do this or do that. Right now with BusyCal, you have to go into BusyCal and change your refresh time or you have to manually reload. It's not a great solution, so we don't tout it as supported.
Right.
So if we send to someone, it works with a workaround, but we're not going to officially say it's supported unless the experience is the best it can be.
Yeah, I have to say I've been using it with BusyCal and it generally works. I don't think it works as well as it does with iCal, like you said, for those updating reasons. But I can't remember. I don't even know if I had changed my preferences. I probably already had it set to a more frequent update time. So it's worked pretty seamlessly for me in most cases. Every once in a while, I notice something takes a little bit longer than I would have thought to update. But, you know, really minor in terms of that. But it's nice to know that you guys are going to be improving upon that.
Exactly. And I mean, the user experience is not necessarily horrible, but if we're going to say that we support it and we're going to put it in, you know, our app,
in writing, setup, yeah.
We're gonna put on, it needs to be, we really care about the experience and we're not going to do something half-baked. There's certain things we have to do. For example, our support with Entourage and Outlook. Entourage and Outlook, just by the way that they work, they have to be launched. There's nothing we can do about it. So that's how it works. If you want to use Entourage or Outlook, the app has to be launched. We are going to look to ways, and we're already starting to work on some ways to even improve that. But that's the point. If we know that there's a way by like working with BusyMac, we can make the experience better, then we're going to do that before we launch it because we really want it to be perfect. So back to the answer of the question for the iPhone and iPad. It is something we want to do. We actually do have an iPhone app or slash universal iPhone iPad app out now. We did a project, a collaboration with appshopper.com.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually created their iPhone slash iPad client.
Cool.
And that application was fully done by Kent and I, and we wrote that application. And an update's actually coming out pretty soon. It'll be coming out probably next week, version 1.4. And that's an app that we really enjoyed making because we really like the service App Shopper. So that, again, was a labor of love. It was an app that we wanted.
And just for people who aren't familiar with that, what is App Shopper?
So AppShopper is a website that provides both news and reviews and the ability to find what's new, top 200, and the best of all are a list, a wish list and my apps list. And the wish list, basically you find an application just the way you find an app on the App Store, and you can put it on your wish list. And if it drops in price, for example, you could set a notification for it to notify you. So let's say there's an app that you think is too expensive. You add it to your wish list, you turn on notifications, boom, it'll either email you or on the iPhone, iPad version, it'll actually send you a push notification when the price drops.
Cool.
It'll also allow you to organize your own apps. And we wrote an importer, and it's actually available for Windows and Mac, that'll scan your iTunes folder for your apps. So you can easily import all of your apps by running this importer. It's a free download. And all of your apps will be on your My Apps list. Then you can actually see when things change, such as an update or a price drop or a price increase. And it's just a really nice way. One of the things about the App Store is sometimes it's hard to find an app, or sometimes it's hard to find specifically what you're looking for. And AppShopper really makes it very easy to find what you're looking for and sort and search and filter and get notifications about price drops and updates. And that's about it in a nutshell.
Cool. So you do have an iOS app. It's just...
Yes, we do. And it's free. Best of all, it's free.
Very cool. Very cool. And more to, come. Well, yes. Michael, I want to thank you. I think what we had talked about, maybe giving MacCast listeners a couple copies of Fantastical.
Absolutely.
Or one each, really. We're going to give away two. And yep. So I thought a great way to do that would be, since it's a calendar app, we'll go off of date. And today, as I'm recording this, is Friday, May 27th, so 5/27. So I think we're doing two copies. So if you just shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com, and just make sure that you put the word Fantastical in the subject line. And let me see if I get the spelling right. Fantastical, right? Yep, did I do that right?
Yep, and the only capital letter is a capital F.
Okay, so put Fantastical anywhere in the subject line. I'm not going to count anybody who doesn't include that in their subject line, but the 5th email that I get and the 27th email that I get will get you hooked up, and we'll get you a copy of Fantastical. And everybody else, it's available on the App Store, right, Michael?
That's right, on the Mac App Store and on our own website at flexibits.com.
So flexibits.com, and that's FLEXIBITS.com.
That's right.
All right, and any other things you want to let people know about? I know you guys, you Twitter, and you're on Twitter, and people can follow you there. I'm assuming maybe there's some other locations people can keep up to date with what's going on with Flexibits and updates to Fantastical.
Yeah, we actually have a Facebook page as well. So it's just facebook.com/flexibits. And we're going to do some more kind of fun things on the Facebook page, because we realize Twitter and Facebook are a little bit different. Twitter is more for communications and kind of quick support, where Facebook is, I think, a little bit more to maybe share stuff, maybe a promo or a giveaway or even a preview or something like that. So if you're on Facebook, you can like us again at facebook.com/flexibits. We also have our website and our blog. And we're going to post on our blog, actually, in the future, a post on the development of Fantastical with some of the images and design stuff that we did along the way, so you can kind of get more input. So
cool.
If you want to check out our blog, we're not sure exactly when this blog post will hit, because we're right now so busy trying to get our updates out.
Sure.
But it's definitely going to happen.
Yeah, priorities, right?
Exactly.
But people should watch that, because that sounds like it'll be a good supplement to a lot of the things that we talked about in this episode.
Yep, exactly.
So check that out and follow Flexibits and grab the app. I mean, you have a free trial, so people can try it out or just pick it up on the App Store.
Exactly. They can come to our website, download the 14-day trial. And just so you know, the 14-day trial is completely unlimited. You can do everything. And then after 14 days, you just can't add events. But you can actually still use the calendar if you want, with just some reminders every few hours.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, thanks, Michael. Appreciate you coming by the MacCast and sharing with us what you've been up to.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on, Adam.
So there you go. Michael Simmons from Flexibits. I want to thank him once again for coming on the show. It's always great to talk with Michael. Really smart guy, as you hear there, and making great products. Check out Fantastical. That's going to do it for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment. Thank all of our show sponsors. Gazelle, get cash for your used electronics. Just do a simple search and get a straightforward upfront offer. Not have to deal with the hassles of auction sites or classified listings, gazelle.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. Check out their software as well as get free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, text expander, PDF pen, disk label. They make a number of great products that you should really take a look at. They have free trials as well as more information over on their website, smilesoftware.com. Pharonix, check out Deep Freeze and PowerSave Mac. Get information, details, as well as demos over at pharonix.com. And Stitcher, Stitcher Smart Radio. You can get more information on their app. It streams podcasts and radio stations direct to your device without having to do the syncing, without having to remember to connect it to iTunes. You can get more information and details. And right now, if you sign up, new listeners who sign up have a chance to win an iPad 2. Just head to stitcher.com/maccast for the details, or download the app and use the code MACCAST when you register. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Want to give you one more reminder that I am in the middle of a server move. We're moving the home of the MacCast from one server to another. So if you see any interruptions in the feed or any issues with the website, that's likely what's going on. The forums will be down for a little bit while I move the database and stuff like that. So expect those outages. Also, as mentioned, I'm on vacation next week, so I won't be around. I'll be trying to respond to emails and things like that. I'm around, but I'm not going to be super connected. You know, I'm on vacation. It's once a year. And for some reason, it always coincides with WWTC. That's just luck of the draw. But what are you going to do? And I'll be back with my thoughts and opinions on WWDC the following week. So hang in for that. If you have any feedback for me, any comments, any questions, you can send those to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. The Skype address is the MacCast, and be sure to check out maccast.com when it's back up on the new home. You can get links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast just by checking the show notes. Also, while you're there, check out the MacCast forum at forum.maccast.com and follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/themaccast. I also want to remind you about the MacCast member program. If you'd like to get even more MacCast content each week and support the show, you can sign up to become a MacCast member. I have information and details up at member.maccast.com. Plans start as low as $4 a month. So just for a couple bucks a month, you get extra content. And if you are a current MacCast member, I've had a couple people who didn't realize that there is actually a membership feed that you can subscribe to in iTunes to automatically get those episodes. If you log into your account at member.maccast.com, just click on the podcast feeds link and it has all the details there. It's also in the support pages on member.maccast.com. You should have received an email, but sometimes people don't receive emails after signing up and they didn't get the instructions. So I just wanted to point that out to everyone. So that's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.